We're listening to Tubular Bells, the iconic, eerie theme to the classic The Exorcist, the first horror film to be nominated for a Best Picture Oscar in 1974. It is the horror genre, how it speaks to us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Especially in these pandemic times, what are we thinking to be fascinated by horror films? Are you both attracted to and scared by them? Is it the adrenaline rush? Is it the escapism? Or are the oldies but goodies the best, like The Birds? How about The Shining? 800-642-1234. Adam Lowenstein is a professor of film and media studies at the University of Pittsburgh, where he researches the social significance of horror films and leads Pitt's Horror Studies Working Group. Adam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So you study horror movies as your life work. Where does your fascination of the horror genre come from?
Well, I am one of those happy stories where my childhood obsession was able to be transformed into my career. I've loved horror films and been fascinated by them from my earliest memories. And it's been one of those relationships, you know, as I've become a scholar as well as a fan, that has just kept paying dividends, because I feel like horror, the deeper you get into it, the more complex it becomes. And I feel like I'm still learning a lot about horror all these years later.
Yeah, we're going to look at those complexities and those nuances. But can you share an early memory that you have of watching a horror film?
Oh yeah, there's lots of examples, but one in particular I remember, because it almost seems too poetically appropriate, is my babysitter let me and my brother stay up late one night to watch films that our parents would not allow us to see, and the name of the movie on TV that night was Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
And it's always the babysitter, by the way.
It is. And that movie really terrified us and fascinated us, and probably made this conversation today possible in some way.
My earliest memories was, you know, when A Nightmare on Elm Street came out and the Freddy Krueger movies, and they came out, we rented them on VHS tape. Of course, these were these devices that we called VCRs in those days. Yeah. And, you know, we were watching like Friday the 13th movies, and I saw them, Adam, at what was called a lock-in at my ice skating rink, which was once a year. All the figure skaters were locked into the ice rink all night long, and we watched like Freddy Krueger movies, and we ate candy and we skated, and just the idea that we were locked into a cold, dark building without a parent was the yes. scariest thing. But which brings me to my question for you is, sometimes I think where we watch these movies and who we are in the company, who's in our company, it really matters a lot to the genre and to our what we take away from it.
I absolutely agree. And that's a wonderful story that you just shared that I think really illustrates the sense that horror is a full sensory immersion experience. It's not just the film. It's what you are bringing to the film as a viewer, and that of course includes the viewing conditions and the people you're seeing it with, and the presence or absence, as it may be, of sort of parental supervision. All of that matters, and I do really feel like there's a horror age too, in that there's a particular moment in most people's lives where they're particularly receptive to horror, or they decide at that moment, no, this is not for me, and I'm not going to be watching these sorts of films. I happen to actually marry somebody like that, interestingly. It really is very context dependent and idiosyncratic, even though horror is such a universal genre.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Adam Lowenstein, who's a professor of film and media studies at the University of Pittsburgh, also the director of the university's horror studies working group, as we look at the genre, what it means, and how it informs our societal, our social values today. Join in at 800-642-1234. You know, I think I read this article in Vox, and it I think it really speaks to what we might be driving at here, that they said that horror movies have moved away from this formula of stab, wipe, repeat. How is the genre evolving? How is it changing?
Well, horror, I think, is experiencing a real sort of golden age right now, in that the sort of the playing field is more open to more different kinds of horror than is often the case. And I think, you know, that formula you just stated is really something that comes from a particular subgenre of the horror film, which is the slasher film, you know, the sort of the kind of film that has its antecedents in Psycho and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but really sort of came into focus with Halloween in 1978. And as you can see, Halloween has a new franchise entry right now. So, you know, this has been a very durable formula, but I think for a lot of viewers, they see this formula as limited and predictable in certain ways, but often that's the appeal as well. But there's also room now for other kinds of horror films beyond the slasher film. And of course, you know, perhaps most famously, you know, we had in 2017, the successes of Get Out and The Shape of Water, both critically, commercially, and at the Academy Awards. These are films that won Academy Awards, which is not often the province of the horror film. So it's a good moment for horror in terms of variety and possibility.
Well, let's pick up on Get Out, which is directed by Jordan Peele. It really challenges racial stereotypes and challenges our expectations for what horror movies are. How did Get Out explore modern racism and really push the boundaries of the horror genre?
Well, Get Out is just a wonderful achievement and a very important film for the horror genre, particularly in I think making mainstream audiences understand the potential that horror has always harbored all along. I think there's been a sort of common misperception that horror thrives negatively on what we would call otherness. This idea that the monsters in horror films are sort of literal or metaphorical versions of different sorts of minority groups that majority society fears in some way. You know, women, Jews, Blacks, the queer, the elderly, the poor, the disabled, the indigenous. And you can certainly find examples of those sorts of things throughout the history of horror. But I think what Jordan Peele does so compellingly is he shows us that horror has never been primarily about demonizing or othering those groups. Horror has been a vehicle for those groups to voice their own pain and anguish as oppressed, marginalized minority members of a majority society that does not consider them to be fully human in some way. And Get Out gets that, and it helps us get that as well.
So it can be this social commentary, if you will. It can make us uncomfortable more than just the basics of a horror film and the jump scare, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important to understand that horror does so many things in so many different ways. And for most people, the first thing they think of in terms of defining a horror film has to do with scares. You know, if this film doesn't scare me, if it doesn't make me jump, it can't really be a horror film. And I just absolutely disagree with that sort of formulation, because there are so many horror films that do things like unnerve, disturb, haunt, terrify, frighten, You know, the verbs are almost endless, and it seems like horror should be considered across more categories than simply the jump scare, you know, which I think has tended to be the place most people assume horror has to live.
Yeah. At the end of the day, they just mess with our minds. Film studies professor Adam Lowenstein taking us through the horror film genre, explaining the attraction. He's all in on horror studies as director of University of Pittsburgh's Horror Studies Working Group. What horror movie were you looking forward to most this year? Was it good as you had hoped? Do you like to rewatch movies even though you know what will happen? Do you still get the jump scare? How do you feel after watching these movies? What goes through you? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. This is The Haunting Score from the 1982 science fiction horror film directed by John Carpenter, The Thing. It is a cult classic, inspired other horror films. We're discussing the significance of the genre on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Have you seen the newest Halloween movie? What did you think? What scary movie do you keep coming back to again and again? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. University of Pittsburgh film studies professor Adam Lowenstein is with us for the hour. Adam, you know, horror films, they put women into this stereotypical box that they're these helpless victims. Lord knows that they can't save themselves. You know, how is the genre starting to walk that line of giving agency to women characters on the screen?
Well, this is an area where I would really say horror is experiencing a fundamental and galvanizing shift, and it's partly driven by the fact that we have more opportunities now than ever before in history for women directors to direct their own horror films. And it's still, you know, we have a long way to go, as the industry in general has a long way to go. But there are more women having more opportunities to direct more horror films now than ever before, and it's such an exciting thing to see these incredible talents emerging and really changing our sense of what a horror film is and what a horror film does, and how women's voices don't have to be boxed into something that seems, you know, empty and stereotypical and limited, but that there's a whole vocabulary of what I would call feminine horror that really blows the doors open on what the genre can be about.
I wonder what it's doing in particular, because as you mentioned, you know, women are directing more horror films. They've been vastly underrepresented in making movies in the male-dominated film industry. How might they influence this genre?
Well, I think of a couple recent examples as sort of pointing the way towards what we might see in the future. One from 2014 is The Babadook, which is an Australian horror film directed by Jennifer Kent that gives us a very scary interpretation of a sort of a ghostly malignant presence sort of invading the home of a mother and her young son. And the film is very effective in its supernatural components, but to me, it is ultimately about the difficulties of being a single mother. And there's a way in which Jennifer Kent's able to capture that in that film in a way that I think is very unusual, not just in the horror genre, but in film in general. There's a sort of understanding for that situation that is deep and profound. And the other film I would mention is this year's Titan, the French horror film directed by Julia Ducournau, who is now on a hot streak. She directed Raw a couple years back, which was phenomenal, and now this film is even more impressive, and it really is something to see. If it's hard to describe if you haven't seen it, but it basically has to do with a young girl who experiences a traumatic car accident when she's young, and sort of is put on a very strange path towards sort of the intersection of her body and the automobile as part of her body. So that's a beginning definition, but you'll have to see it in order to
believe it.
yes, indeed.
Adam Lowenstein with us, professor of film and media studies at the University of Pittsburgh, as we discuss the social influences of horror movies, why they speak to us, and hearing about the horror movies that you have seen in the past that have affected you, and in what way. 800-642-1234. You know, film scholars will tell us that there was this post 9/11 horror cinema change, bringing on more bleak and more chaos, more chaotic themes and subjects. It really makes me wonder what the pandemic we're living through and how climate change and other catastrophes, what they're doing to the genre and how it will change.
Yes, I think we will see in the years to come just how deeply the pandemic will impact the language of horror. But just looking back at previous historical moments, we could see how profoundly traumatic historical events do affect the language and texture of horror. I mean, you mentioned the post 9/11 boom in films that were labeled, I think, misleadingly as torture porn. And then even earlier, of course, our first real wave of horror genre films in the United States was in the 1930s with the first Universal horror films. These are the first versions of Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, and others. And this coincided with the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of evidence, and of course in the 70s as well, another golden age, you know, coinciding with the Vietnam era. So there's a lot of evidence for horrors sort of thriving in more traumatic historical periods. But at the same time, horror never has a bad season. You know, it's always around. We always need it in some way. And there's no such thing as an era that's so calm and peaceful that there's no room for horror, and sometimes it's precisely that calmness that sort of demands the horror in certain ways. So I do believe history matters and it's important, but I also think horror is primal as well, and we need it at all times.
While you're reaching back into the archives here, I want to bring up Night of the Living Dead, one of George Romero's most popular movies. You have a deep appreciation of George Romero and his works. What did you see in Night of the Living Dead?
Oh, Night of the Living Dead is one of my very favorites, and I'm honored to serve on the board of directors of the George A. Romero Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving Romero's legacy, but also promoting what he did best, which is socially conscious horror. And in many ways, without Romero, we would not have films like Get Out or Shape of Water or Titan or The Babadook. Many of these films that see horror in a socially conscious way are directly indebted to Romero and to Night of the Living Dead in particular, because what Romero achieved with Night of the Living Dead is a film that came out at the height of the Vietnam era in the U.S. and seemed to be able to plug in almost supernaturally to the trauma of that era. If you haven't seen the film, I don't want to spoil it for you, but it is a savage commentary on the Vietnam War, on the civil rights struggle, on all of the conflicts that were ripping America apart at that time and whose legacies we still feel.
And prominently and, featuring a Black lead actor.
That's correct. Dwayne Jones, who's a University of Pittsburgh alumnus, I might add, was a driver for meaning in that film. And his presence gives a resonance to the violence and the horror in the film that wouldn't be possible without an African-American lead actor, which was a very rare thing at that time in 1968. It's still too rare now, but it's something that gives the film a real charge that's quite unforgettable.
We're discussing horror movies. Film studies professor Adam Lowenstein of the University of Pittsburgh, home to the Horror Studies Archive that was recently created by Pitt's University Library System. What do you think of these films? What about their soundtracks that haunt you? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Adam Lowenstein after a news update on the Ideas Network. This is a famous theme from a John Carpenter movie. It's the Halloween theme song. We're having a horror film hour here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The 2017 version of Stephen King's It commands the top spot of the highest-grossing horror movies in history. Is Halloween or It a favorite of yours? Are you a white knuckler, as they say, feeling intense emotions when you watch these movies? Why do you put yourself through them? 800-642-1234. University of Pittsburgh Film Studies professor Adam Lowenstein focuses on the social significance of these movies and is with us for the hour. Let's bring in Lulu in Appleton. Hi, Lulu.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, are you there? You watch The Haunting.
Every year. the early 1960s version. Not the later version. And I watch it because it's a psychological thriller kind of turned into a ghost story. And the soundtrack is very good. And the visuals are really interesting. The way the film is shot is particularly interesting. Every year I watch it.
Oh, Lulu, thank you for bringing that up. Adam, Lulu, appreciating the 1963 British horror film. You know, what would you say about The Haunting?
Well, I would say Lulu's got great taste. I think it's it's an amazing film and well worth watching every year, if not more often. And The Haunting, I think, is often thought about as a horror film that stretches the boundaries, as we were talking about earlier, about what horror can be. The Haunting is not a film with a monster or a ghost or a scene of spectacular violence to sort of fill out its spectacle. It's all very much based on sound and suggestion and psychological disintegration as its source of horror, it's been a very influential film, particularly with the wave of J-horror or Japanese horror films that sort of revitalized the genre in the late 90s and early 2000s. The Haunting and The Innocents were key films for those filmmakers.
And I think adapted from The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. So let's give a shout out to Shirley Jackson, which kind of begs that question of the influence of literature on horror film.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, if we think about horror films as descending from many sources, but of course from literature and from Gothic literature in particular, we can see that women have had a strong voice in the genre for a long time. We think about, you know, you mentioned Shirley Jackson, but also of course Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and of course Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights is one of the great Gothic horror novels. Most people think of it as a romance, but sort of forget that you know, this is a film that, sorry, a novel that deals with ghosts and darkness and death. There's a reason it's considered a Gothic classic.
Lulu, thanks. Let's go to Benny now in southern Wisconsin. Benny, how about Poltergeist?
I just felt so much evil in that movie. That's the scariest horror film that I think I've ever seen. And I seen it back in the 70s when the original came out, and I've never watched it again.
Oh, wow. So still haunted by Poltergeist.
Still haunted. Yeah. Yes.
Adam, what can you say there?
Well, I'm very impressed with the taste of your listeners, because I think Poltergeist is a great film as well, and it's actually the man who directed Poltergeist is Toby Hooper, who about a decade earlier brought us the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and a lot of people think of Poltergeist as a Steven Spielberg production, in that Spielberg produced it, and it came out at a time where Spielberg was incredibly influential with films like, you know, E.T. and the such. You know, it has a very Steven Spielberg suburban feel, but it's all Toby Hooper in terms of its very intense, visceral horror that I think has marked a lot of audiences like your call-in listener.
You mentioned sound earlier. What makes a good horror movie soundtrack? What makes it memorable and get under our skin?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, we often think of horror primarily in terms of images, because the horror film has generated so many iconic frightening images. But I think it's often sound that sort of gets under our skin most viscerally. I had an interesting incident myself recently where my daughter is 10 years old, and she knows what her dad does, but she's a little daunted by it. But she expressed a desire to see Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's original Psycho. And so I watched it with her, and she told me that she was much more frightened by the music than by anything else in the movie. And that if she had been able to watch the movie without any sound, she doesn't think it would have frightened her at all. But as it turned out, it frightened her quite severely.
Yeah, that's very profound for a 10-year-old to make that
yes.
connection, that the sound of that movie is really having the effect on them.
I think, you know, this goes to show what happens when your dad is Dr. Horror.
We're talking Dr. Horror, Adam Lowenstein, professor of film and media studies at the University of Pittsburgh, as we explore the significance of the horror genre and why people are fascinated by scary movies. We heard from Justin in Appleton, called in. Adam couldn't stay with us. And Justin is really interested in the mythology of horror movies and would love you to elaborate on mythology and what they do in horror movies.
Yes, I think this speaks to something I touched on briefly earlier about sort of the primal experience of horror. You know, horror is something that speaks to our sort of deepest feelings and experiences and sensations, and of course that all ties into beliefs and stories that go way back. So things like mythology, folklore, different sorts of religious tales, and you know, even oral tradition sorts of narratives. Horror taps into it all, because, you know, the deeper it goes, the more primal it becomes. And I think we all carry around a sense that, you know, there's things that we don't fully control or don't fully understand, that horror gives us a way of looking in on in some sort of sense, and confronting in some sort of way. And so the mythological aspects of horror, I think, you know, we can find them in just about every horror film, horror novel, horror video game, even. You can always see how these stories are so primal and deep and have all of these iconic figures that we all instantly recognize.
Circle back to just a point you made in passing earlier, that torture porn, movies like Saw, sometimes called torture porn, featuring really graphic or blunt violence and torture, and you find that they're mislabeled. What do you make of that?
Well, the connotation of torture porn is unfortunate, I think, because it suggests that these films somehow go beyond the pale, that they are sort of irresponsible and sort of wildly excessive in terms of their violence and their graphic gore. But I think it's more honest to say that horror's job is to push the envelope and to confront us and to make us uncomfortable and to show us things we would rather not see. And if you go back and read the initial reviews of Frankenstein in 1931, you'll read things that sound a lot like the critical dismissals of torture porn in the post 9/11 2000s. You know, things like, what have we come to as a culture where we have a movie that's about dead bodies being stitched together and walking around? Like, who are we that we want this and have this on the screen? So I think, to me, torture porn is not beyond the pale. It is part and parcel of horror's heartbeat.
Let's bring on another caller. Terry is with us from Genoa. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, yeah, you grew up on the 80s horror movies.
Yeah, you know, Halloween is a favorite. Of course, all of them. Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. I definitely appreciate those scares with the music, the lighting, the sound effects, a lot more than I do the gore. But now I'm trying to watch some of those older ones. I just watched The Mummy, the 1932 version. I've got Dracula on the list, Frankenstein, Nosferatu. So that's kind of where I'm heading now.
Adam, help her out. Help Terry out with what she should line up there to watch in some of these old ones.
Well, Terry, I think you're off to a great start there. Going back to some of the classics, I think, is a great way to sort of renew your appreciation for more recent horror films. And you know, a cycle of horror films I would throw in that Terry hasn't already mentioned that I think is well worth returning to is a series of films in the 1940s produced by Val Lewton for RKO Studios in the U.S. And these were films like Cat People and I Walked with a Zombie, The Seventh Victim, and these are all wonderfully atmospheric subtle horror films that really, I think, point the way towards some of the genre's more ambitious and intellectual sorts of endeavors in later years.
Yeah, reaching back deep into that archive, Professor Adam Lowenstein of the University of Pittsburgh. With us, horror film scholar, do you release pent-up emotions by watching these films? Have you been more or less attracted to them in the pandemic? Why do you think that is? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Adam Lowenstein here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. One of my most vivid memories in the movie theater was seeing the Blair Witch Project opening weekend at the iconic Uptown Theater in Minneapolis. Do you remember the hype, the intrigue? Was it real or fictitious? What about that found footage, right? 1999, the dawn of the internet, anything is possible. This, by the way, also the theater where we went to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show. All you baby boomers, Gen Xers, join in on movie theater film experiences in the horror genre. 800-642-1234. University of Pittsburgh film scholar Adam Lowenstein with us for 10 more minutes. Adam, Blair Witch Project, you know, there was talk about messing with our minds because we were like having this conflict about what was true, what was fiction. How did that movie change things on the horror scene?
I think the influence of Blair Witch has been profound, and I was happy to hear your anecdote about remembering how you saw it, because that's one of those films that it really mattered how you saw it. Mm-hmm. And if you were able to see it in its initial theatrical release, it depends even on the week that you saw it, because there was this initial rush of attention around the film where there was a real question about whether this was authentic or sort of manufactured, and I think if you were lucky enough to get to see it during that brief window before it became very clear that this was, of course, a film like any other, a constructed film, not a found documentary. Mm-hmm. You had the experience of a real kind of visceral excitement. I mean, I can remember seeing it in a big theater in Chicago, and I felt like the movie industry was going to change, because here was this no budget, unknown, gritty horror film, and the place was packed to the rafters. I can remember people standing in the aisles.
Yes,
And just shortly before, at the same theater, I'd seen Star Wars Episode One, and it wasn't comparable. I mean, the excitement in the theater around Blair Witch was so much more intense than around this big budget Hollywood spectacle. And it felt like, wow, you know, maybe things are really gonna change. But of course, you know, with every change comes more of the same as well.
Well, how about we go to another call? Craig is joining us from Gaze Mills. Hi, Craig. What movie would you like to bring up?
Well, our library's film society, and we show films monthly, recently showed Rosemary's Baby from 1968, and we billed it as a horror film. In fact, some people didn't even come because they were afraid they were going to be too afraid. But we actually found that it wasn't all that scary anymore, but it was fascinating in the sense that the female lead, the manipulation, the psychological manipulation of the female lead, and of course that the whole movie hinges on a rape, which wasn't really even acknowledged as much as such, it seemed like, in the film.
Yeah. Adam, what do you make of that?
I think I'm going to have to move to Wisconsin, because your audience has such excellent taste in horror films.
There's
really
a position
Rosemary's
for
Baby.
You at UW-Madison. Close your ears, Pitt.
I think Rosemary's Baby is a very important horror film, and it's interesting to bring up the question of do horror films need to make us jump out of our seats? Rosemary's Baby probably doesn't, but I think Rosemary's Baby will haunt you and disturb you in ways over a longer term period of time than lots of films that may make you jump out of your seat in the moment. And I think that's something that Jordan Peele understood when Rosemary's Baby and The Stepford Wives, which are both novels by the great Jewish American horror author Ira Levin, before they became films, really got from films and novels like Rosemary's Baby, is that sense of dread that comes with the idea that Rosemary experiences of, you know, as she says, sometimes there really are plots against people. And when you're in the minority, if you're a woman or if you're Black, this becomes part of your everyday experience, not something fictional.
You bring up Jewish horror films, and you're exploring them in a book project, writing a book about the influences. What have you discovered about Jewish horror films and even labeling them as such?
Yeah, I am in the midst of research about this, and I've got a book coming out this summer in July called Horror Film and Otherness. That's really about rethinking the genre's relation to these social categories of difference. You know, whether that's being a woman or being Black or being Jewish or being Indigenous or queer or elderly or disabled. And really sort of pushing against that assumption that horror demonizes these groups rather than gives these groups a way to voice their experience. And I think in the Jewish context, it's particularly fascinating because, you know, there's a way in which, you know, many people would say Jewish horror, like, you know, who needs it? You know, there's so much real horror in the Jewish experience that, you know, with people who have experienced the Holocaust, why would we need fictional horror to deal with the world? But I think it's precisely the opposite in many ways, is that we need horror in order to understand the things that are most horrible and traumatic. And of course, it's the horror film that has a vocabulary for the awful and the painful and the anguished. And I think there is a sort of a subterranean Jewish horror tradition that needs to sort of be understood more in the light that I'm working on. And Ira Levin is certainly part of that in Rosemary's Baby.
We only have a few seconds left, but you mentioned that horror has this vocabulary. It is evolving. What are you watching for in this genre?
I feel like horror is really sort of coming into its own as something that doesn't need to worry anymore in the same kinds of ways about being disrespected or not taken seriously or sort of considered a lower form of art or culture. I think horror is gaining confidence about its importance and its significance. And you can see more and more filmmakers treating horror with the respect that I think it deserves. And I think it's drawing talents to the genre that may not have been drawn to the genre in earlier times. So I'm looking forward to seeing the blossoming of all of that.
Adam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Adam Lowenstein, a professor of film and media studies at the University of Pittsburgh. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.